is simply not the availability because of the production process for monoclonal antibodies versus vaccines, widely documented. This stuff is all out in the open. You can find it. Then he says the monoclonal antibodies have you just get rid of COVID. It just cures you. We have randomized controlled trials with monoclonal antibodies. They are efficacious. It is not a silver bullet. It is not a silver bullet. And if you are in a situation where you need monoclonal antibodies, you are far better off being vaccinated. So understand that the two first claims, there's an artificial shortage, demonstrably untrue. It simply kills COVID. Not true. It's effective. It's an effective treatment. OK. Also, by the way, then he goes into the financial. He says there's a financial. It must be. Jocko says, what's the point here? Why? Is it financial? And Rogan says it must be. The vaccines are made by pharmaceutical companies, which make money from vaccines. The monoclonal antibodies are made by pharmaceutical companies that make money from monoclonal antibodies. You can't ascribe a profit motive to one and not the other. It's for-profit pharmaceutical companies making both. So it's a wacky claim to make. And in addition to that, the vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, is now fully approved by the FDA. The monoclonal antibodies are authorized for emergency use. When we say, well, we don't know, we really, I mean, if you want to make that case, we now know more from a regulatory standpoint about the Pfizer vaccine than the monoclonal antibodies, but that is missing. And then lastly, you know, everybody, vaccinated people want the unvaccinated to get a vaccine because they want others to take a risk the way they. That is crazy. That is crazy. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. And everyone knows someone who's had a bad reaction. I don't know anyone who's had a bad reaction. I mean, I know people who were flu-like for 24 hours. I was. My girlfriend's arm got red for a little while, for like 8 hours or something like that. I don't know anybody who's had really a bad. So it's so silly. And unfortunately, it's going over a line into something that now is getting much more dangerous than, you know, JFK or flat earth. Or not that Rogan believes all this stuff, but some of this stuff is more benign. This is very much not. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192 David P. Here's a very aggressive voicemail question.
Yes, David. Just curious. I watch your show from time to time. I was curious as to why you never talked about Hunter Biden.
Yeah.
And all the millions of dollars that he has received from China and Russia, and the fact that that is probably why Joe Biden does not take any action towards either one of those countries because he has been compromised.
Yeah, listen, so first of all, most of the things that this caller said, who interestingly sounds a lot like Troy York and also calls from Illinois, but apparently is a different caller. First of all, those claims are essentially all unproven. It's unproven that Hunter Biden received money from those governments. There is an investment firm co-founded by Hunter Biden, which did have a consulting agreement with the mayor of Moscow. It involves a whole bunch of other people. There is no evidence that Joe Biden got any money or that Joe Biden is involved in any way. And most importantly, Hunter Biden isn't involved in the administration in any way. You know, Ivanka Trump, Eric Trump, Don Jr., they were highly present in Donald Trump's administration. They were sitting at the table. Ivanka sat at the table at, what was it, the G8 or the G20 or whatever it was, filling in for then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. And these very same people that now want to draw some link to Joe Biden from things Hunter Biden did in the past, allegedly, and Hunter has no involvement whatsoever in Joe Biden's administration. Where were they on Ivanka, Eric, Don Jr. and Jared Kushner during the Trump administration? These people are pathetic, and there is really no what do you want me to talk about Hunter Biden? The guy's nowhere. He's not present in any way or involved at all. We've got a great bonus show for you today. I won't even tell you what's on today's bonus show. It's a good one. Sign up at JoinPack.
WRCT in sound. From way out.
D. DJ Haim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-syllable word.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is a really low moment, and it has forced a moment of reckoning for the abortion rights movement. And I think one of the things that stood out in the interviews that I did with dozens of people across the movement is that the failure to act with urgency on the erosion of the rights of poor people and women of color many decades ago helped lead the movement to the point where it is today, where it has lost so much ground on the issue of abortion rights.
As the Supreme Court looks poised to uphold Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban and possibly overturn Roe v. Wade, we'll speak to the nation's Amy Littlefield about the Christian legal army behind the Mississippi law, as well as anti-trans laws across the country. Plus, we get a remarkable look at the life inside Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia, the subject of a new documentary called The Facility.
How's everybody doing? What's happening here?
Nobody here. There's the fucking coronavirus.
I'm really scared I'm gonna die.
This is what we came up with to try to protect ourselves.
The woman, they're going to go on strike.
And what happened to the Haitian asylum seekers in Texas, some of whom were whipped by U.S. Border Patrol agents?
My colleagues and I have been working for the last 2 months to liberate some of the same men who were under the bridge in Del Rio, Texas, 2 months ago and are now detained in this horrible detention center.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Biden administration's prepared to reinstate the contested Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy as soon as next week after it reached an agreement with the Mexican government. This means asylum seekers who arrive at the southern U.S. border will once again be returned and forced to wait in Mexico while their cases are resolved in U.S. courts, a process that can take months or even years. Advocates warn Biden has expanded the program to now potentially include asylum seekers from the entire Western Hemisphere. This comes despite mounting reports of human rights violations and other grave dangers faced by asylum seekers while stuck in Mexico. This is a Salvadoran asylum seeker in Juarez, Mexico, speaking Thursday from a migrant shelter near the U.S. border.
I have been here 22 days. Being here for a long time is desperate. We have children, and we are here without our families. To stay here another 6 months is very difficult. Thank God we have food here. We have everything we need, but it is hard to be without our families.
Advocates have vowed to continue fighting Remain in Mexico. The ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project said in a statement, quote, the reimplementation of this illegal and cruel policy will inflict on thousands of additional people seeking asylum the same harms that were well documented under its previous implementation, horrific abuse, including torture, rape and death, and the denial of any meaningful opportunity to obtain asylum, the ACLU said. German leaders have ordered tough new restrictions for people not vaccinated against COVID-19 as Germany and many other European nations experience their worst surge of the pandemic. Germany's new rules bar unvaccinated people who haven't had a previous infection from public life, from restaurants, theaters, stores, and many other venues. Outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel said officials may make vaccinations mandatory by February. Meanwhile, COVID-19 cases in South Africa have nearly tripled in just 3 days amidst a fourth surge linked to the Omicron coronavirus variant. On Thursday, South African scientists warned people with a previous coronavirus infection appear to have little immunity to Omicron and are highly susceptible to reinfection. President Biden visited the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, Thursday, where he laid out his public health strategy for battling COVID-19 this winter.
And it doesn't include shutdowns or lockdowns, but widespread vaccinations and boosters and testing and a lot more.
Biden's plan will require private health insurers to reimburse their customers for the cost of over-the-counter at-home COVID-19 tests. 50 million tests would be made available to the uninsured for free through health centers and rural clinics. This comes as hospitalizations and deaths are once again on the rise across the United States, with more than 1,000 U.S. residents dying of COVID-19 on average each day. At least five states have now detected cases of the Omicron coronavirus variant. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul urged all 53,000 people who attended a November anime convention in Manhattan to get tested after a Minnesota man who traveled to the event was found to have been infected with Omicron. Other cases have been found in New York, Colorado, California, and Hawaii. On Capitol Hill, House and Senate lawmakers approved a stopgap spending bill Thursday evening that funds government operations through mid-February. Senators narrowly defeated a Republican amendment that would have defunded COVID-19 vaccine mandates for businesses, military members, and federal workers. Many Republicans had threatened to shut down the government in protest of vaccine mandates. Oregon Congressmember Peter DeFazio said Wednesday he will not seek re-election in 2022. DeFazio is currently chair of the House Transportation Committee, serving his 18th term in Congress. He's the 19th House Democrat to announce their retirement ahead of midterm elections next year, in which Republicans are expected to benefit from gerrymandered congressional districts and sweeping new voter suppression laws. Last month, California Democrat Jackie Speier announced she will not run for an 8th term in Congress. A survivor of the Jonestown massacre when she was a congressional aide in 1978. She more recently co-led a resolution to censure Republican Congressman Paul Gosar after he posted a violent animated video depicting himself murdering Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for which he was censured. Human rights groups are demanding the United Nations reopen an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen after the UN Human Rights Council voted in October against extending an independent war crimes investigation. Dozens of organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, said in a joint statement Thursday that Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates bribed, coerced, and arm-twisted council members to win a 21-18 vote ordering an end to the war crimes probe, which was set up 4 years ago. Agnès Callamard, the Secretary General of Amnesty International, said all parties to the conflict in Yemen, including Saudi and Houthi forces, have committed atrocities with impunity.
There is seemingly no end in sight for this war. There is no light that we can see at the end of the tunnel. For that reason, we have to act now, because every day that goes by, far more people are being harmed and killed. And indeed, to say that a mechanism could save millions of lives is not an exaggeration.
The UN estimates about 250,000 people have been killed as a result of Yemen's war, with some 4 million Yemenis displaced since the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition intervened in 2015. A new report by Human Rights Watch finds Burmese security forces encircled and killed anti-coup protesters at a demonstration in Rangoon in March as part of a pre-planned attack. At least 65 people were shot dead. According to a local rights monitor, over 1,300 people have been killed by the military junta since the February 1st coup. This comes as the announcement of the first verdicts in a series of charges against deposed and detained civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi was delayed until Monday of next week. A record-breaking winter heat wave had residents of Washington State, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, and Canada feeling like it was mid-spring this week. Parts of British Columbia hit 72.5 degrees, a record high for the region. In Montana, the unusually hot and dry weather has set prairies ablaze, with two dozen homes and businesses catching fire in the rural town of Denton. In southern Oregon, Canadian oil and gas company Pembina Pipeline has abandoned plans for a frack gas pipeline and export terminal after years of organizing and community pushback. Opponents argued the project violated the Clean Water Act and threatened local wildlife, livelihoods, and indigenous land. In other climate victories, Shell has pulled out of the Cambo oil field project in the UK's North Sea. The announcement came after an intense pressure campaign by activists who petitioned the British government against the potential environmental disaster. Shell cited economic reasons for canceling the project. Climate activists are demanding the government follow suit and drop its support of the oil field project. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken indicated President Biden will likely soon speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin as tensions continue to mount over the military buildup at Russia's border with Ukraine. Blinken made the statement after meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov Thursday. Meanwhile, Ukraine's military said it's conducting artillery drills near the border of Russian-annexed Crimea. Russia has denied it has plans for any military action and blamed Ukrainian allies for the current situation. This is Sergei Lavrov.
NATO continues to escalate the situation on our borders, refuses to consider our proposal to de-escalate tensions and prevent dangerous incidents.
The Biden administration has rejected calls to ban the use of lethal autonomous weapons, also known as killer robots. During a United Nations meeting in Geneva Thursday, the U.S. instead proposed establishing a code of conduct for their use. Activists across the globe have long warned of the growing threat posed by robots that use artificial intelligence and lethal weapons to kill without a human overseeing the process. At least 60 schools in Michigan closed on Thursday after police warned of potential copycat killings following the Oxford High School shooting on Tuesday, which left four students dead and seven people wounded. On Thursday, prosecutors signaled they may soon bring criminal charges against the parents of the 15-year-old shooter. The boy's father, James Crumbly, purchased the semi-automatic pistol used in the killing just days before the massacre. Prosecutors say the gun was in the boy's backpack during a meeting with his parents and teachers just before the shooting to discuss reports of, quote, concerning behavior. After the meeting, the teen was allowed to return to class. Prosecutors also said Thursday they discovered videos on the boy's cell phone made the night before the shooting in which he talked about shooting and killing students the next day. And social justice and environmental advocate Martha Marty Nathan has died after a battle with lung cancer and congestive heart failure. She was 70 years old. Dr. Nathan was a co-founder of Climate Action Now and the founder of the environmental group 2 Degrees Northampton. She was also a retired physician. Nathan spoke to Democracy Now in 2019 to mark the 40th anniversary of the Greensboro Massacre, when 40 Ku Klux Klansmen and American Nazis opened fire on an anti-Klan demonstration in Greensboro, North Carolina, killing five anti-racist activists, including her husband, in a span of 88 seconds.
Five people were murdered, including my husband, Mike, and 10 people were injured. The police were nowhere to be found.
In 2020, Greensboro's City Council passed a resolution apologizing for the attack and the police department's complicity in the killings. Dr. Marty Nathan said the Greensboro massacre showed how white supremacist violence continues to threaten movements for social and economic justice.
We stand for the rights of people to live and to live decently in a time of climate change, threat of nuclear war, and increasing economic disparity. We all have to be in the streets, and we do not want to get shot.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we talk to the nation's Amy Littlefield about the Christian legal army behind Mississippi's abortion ban and anti-trans legislation around the country and more. Stay with us.
I'm feeling funny, feeling high. They look at me,
Wonder Woman by Lion Babe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the fight for reproductive rights as the Supreme Court appears set to uphold Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban and possibly overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion nationwide. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, almost half of U.S. states could rapidly make abortion illegal, thanks to so-called trigger laws already in place. For decades, right-wing groups have been waging a war on abortion rights, and they appear to be closing in on their goal of overturning Roe, due in part to Donald Trump's appointment of Amy Coney Barrett and Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. One right-wing group has played a key role in this movement, has been the Alliance Defending Freedom, a self-described legal army to fight abortion rights and LGBT rights, especially trans rights. We join now by Amy Littlefield, the abortion access correspondent for The Nation. She has two new pieces out this week, The Christian Legal Army Behind the Ban on Abortion in Mississippi and The Nation, and Where the Pro-Choice Movement Went Wrong, which was an op-ed piece just published by The New York Times. Amy, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you start off by, well, responding to what happened, what you thought was most important to understand about the oral arguments in the Supreme Court on Wednesday? You were outside. Amy, you're muted. If you could start again.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. In terms of what was most remarkable inside the court, I mean, you have Amy Coney Barrett suggesting that the state forcing people to carry pregnancies to term in a country that has the highest maternal mortality rate in the developed world, you know, three times higher for Black women than for white women, that it's no big deal to force people to give birth because they can just bring their baby to the nearest fire station and give them up for adoption. You have Brett Kavanaugh, who was, you know, confirmed saying over and over again that Roe was settled law. It was precedent. And that was that, you know, then on Wednesday listing off all of the different precedents that the Supreme Court has overturned. And wouldn't it be a good thing if they did that again? So I think we saw really clearly that the three conservative justices that were appointed by Donald Trump are getting ready to do exactly what they were put on the court to do, which is overturn Roe v. Wade and take away the nationwide right to legal abortion in this country. You know, and I want to say that the biggest evidence, the biggest argument, if anyone had any remaining doubt that that's what they intend to do, is, you know, not what was going on inside the court, but what's going on many miles away in Texas, where for 3 months, people in the state of Texas, one of the country's largest states, have been dealing with this slow rolling emergency where almost all abortions in the state are banned under a law that empowers anyone to become a bounty hunter and enforce an anti-abortion law against, you know, friends, families, abortion funds, abortion providers, anyone who's helping someone get an abortion. The Supreme Court could have stopped that law before it came into effect. They could have stopped it at any point, you know, over the past 3 months. And that hasn't happened. And so I think the writing is really on the wall. And that's why I've said I think the most important thing that I saw was not what was going on inside the Supreme Court, which was sort of confirmation that they're going to do what you know, the Christian right has been planning for decades. But what I saw outside was an abortion rights movement that was really emboldened, that was prepared, that was debuting the messaging that is going to be needed to rebuild a mass movement to change the culture and to reshape the fight in the years to come after the right to legal abortion falls.
I want to go to what was happening outside just hours before the oral arguments on Wednesday. Activists shouting, shout your abortion, gathered outside the Supreme Court building, chanting abortion pills forever. Then four of them proceeding to take mifepristone in union, the first medication in a typical two-step self-induced medical abortion.
Abortion!
Abortion!
Pills!
Pills!
Forever!
Forever!
Abortion!
Abortion!
Pills!
Pills!
explain what they were doing, Amy.
Yeah, so these were activists with the group Shout Your Abortion. They gathered outside the court. They had white boxes with mifepristone inside them, which they had obtained legally from the group Aid Access, which is an organization based overseas that sends abortion medications to people all across the country. And the laws vary state to state on that, you know, access. But all of these activists were able to obtain that pill legally. It's the first medication that people take in the typical two-step medication abortion regimen, which is administered in clinics, but it's the same, you know, regimen that you can take at home. And they took the pill in front of the court. These were four people who had had abortions. Taking mifepristone by itself isn't going to cause an abortion, but they were taking the pill to make the point that, as organizer Amelia Bano told me, Republicans might have the courts, but we're out here having abortions, right? They can't stop them. That was the point. They're in open defiance of the court. They're saying, you can ban abortion legally, but now that these pills are out there, you can't actually stop people from having abortion. The caveat to that, and it's a huge caveat, obviously, is that what the state can do and has done is criminalize people for involvement in self-managed abortion. We're likely to see that even further when Roe falls. But I think, you know, this direct action was really part of sending the message, trying to raise awareness about getting these pills into people's hands, and part of a strategy of the movement figuring out how people are going to take care of each other and take care of those who need abortions in this post-Roe future that is imminently approaching.
Which sounds exactly like the pre-Roe past, though they might not have had those drugs at the time, but
exactly.
People helping each other.
Right, exactly. That's the key difference, Amy, that those self-support networks are there. You know, that's rising up. That's been there for a long time in states like Texas that have heavily restricted abortion even before, you know, this year. But the tools are very different, right? We're talking about safe medication, the same medication, again, that you can get prescribed in a clinic that many people are now accessing in their own homes. The key is that a lot of people don't know this medication is out there. And so I think the activists were really trying to say, hey, you know, everyone, pay attention to this. Tell all your friends, you know, these pills are available on the internet. And there are safer options now than there were, you know, before 1973.
But of course, there's also severe danger, whether people are able to link into those networks. And we're, of course, also talking about the poorest people in the United States, people who it would not be easy to cross state lines. I mean, even for anyone, it is difficult. But for people who don't have the economic means, this will hit especially hard. And we're talking about almost half of the country. Half of states.
And it's already happening, right? I mean, that's abortion providers and you know, activists in Texas are witnessing this reality every single day of people who can't afford to travel, who can't, you know, get childcare, who can't take off work, who are pregnant, and they can't escape their state where abortion, you know, is banned except in the earliest weeks of pregnancy. And so they're giving up because they have no choice. And so that's already the reality for Texas, which I think by one measure is home to 1 in 10 women of reproductive age. And yeah, we're going to see that, you know, multiplied by potentially, I mean, not all states are the size of Texas, right? But we could see 26 states that are either certain or very likely to ban abortion if Roe falls, a dozen that would do it immediately through these trigger bans if Roe falls.
Talk about the Christian legal army behind the ban on abortion.
Yeah, so this is really important, Amy. I went back and listened to a recording from 2018 when Alliance Defending Freedom, which is this legal engine behind the Christian right agenda, at a conference, an ADF attorney named Denise Burke said, we're going to lay out our plan here to eradicate Roe. And it starts with this Mississippi ban on abortion at 15 weeks that was just introduced, you know, just this week in Mississippi. We introduced our model bill for banning abortion at 15 weeks, and this is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, at the time, she was saying this is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and then we'll come in with a, you know, we'll come in with a complete ban after we get the ban on abortion at 15 weeks. there's been a couple changes since then. They've gotten two more Supreme Court justices. And so, you know, they didn't actually have to wait to ask the court to just go ahead and ban abortion outright using this, you know, Mississippi law that was developed in 2018. But I thought it was really important to point out that this group was the legal architect of the bill that it now seems is going to be used to reverse Roe v. Wade.
So, Amy, I want to play a clip from that tape that you're talking about of attorneys with the Alliance Defending Freedom, or ADF, unveiling this plan, as you said, to eradicate Roe. This is ADF Senior Counsel Denise Burke speaking at the Evangelicals for Life conference.
We're not looking at regulation, we are actually looking to enact abortion bans. We are working with allies in a number of states to do that. And our first ban that we are looking at is a 15-week limitation. So I'm sure you guys have heard of about 21 states have enacted 20-week limitations to this point. The majority of those limitations were never challenged in court. I can speculate as to why the abortion industry did that, but I think they didn't want to get a bad decision. They were concerned that the courts would go along with the 20-week ban. Well, I can guarantee you they're not going to be able to ignore a 15-week limitation, which is, in essence, limiting abortion to the first trimester. And we're kind of basically baiting them. Come on, fight us on turf that we have already set up and established. I'm happy to say the first 15-week limitation, based on our model language, was just introduced in the state of Mississippi this week.
Amy Littlefield, respond to Denise Burke.
Right. So, I mean, she's very clearly saying, hey, guys, this is the plan. We're going to introduce a 15-week ban. They introduced, you know, more than a third of states have implemented a 20-week ban, right? And they said, that wasn't enough to, you know, get the challenge that we wanted. And so we're going to go ahead and move the line up to 15 weeks. And then once we get that 15-week ban, you know, we'll go even further. And so this was part of a carefully orchestrated effort to strike right at the heart of Roe v. Wade. You know, Mississippi is getting a lot of attention right now, right? Everyone's talking about, you know, Mississippi as if this was a state that grew this was a bill that grew organically out of the soil of Mississippi. That is not the case. It was written by the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is an organization with a $50 million annual budget that is out there to drive the Christian right agenda. They write model bills. They work with state lawmakers who are aligned with them to introduce those model bills. Then when the bills get challenged, which in many cases they want them to, they defend those bills in court. They fund the legal cases that they don't defend themselves. And what I most wanted to get across in this piece is the crucial connection that this organization that wrote the Mississippi law that is before the Supreme Court now is also the same organization that is driving the record number of anti-transgender bills that we're seeing in state legislatures across the country. This year shattered records for both anti-trans legislation and anti-abortion legislation. And we are talking about those issues as if they're two separate things. And really what I wanted to point out is this is the same organization that is driving these efforts as part of their Christian right agenda, and we have to understand those connections.
I want to go to Amara Jones. On Thursday, Democracy Now! Spoke to the investigative journalist and host of the Anti-Trans Hate Machine podcast about the Alliance Defending Freedom and about how these attacks on reproductive rights, as you're saying, Amy, are connected to the attacks on transgender rights.
A key way in which these two movements are linked is, in one way, very simple to explain. It's the same groups and the same groups of people. We know that groups such as the Family Research Council, the Heritage Foundation, and Alliance Defending Freedom have all been on the cutting edge of the anti-abortion movement for decades now. And they've just simply taken the tactics that they've learned from the anti-abortion movement and are now applying them to the anti-trans movement. So, for example, we are seeing doctors who provide gender-affirming care now being targeted by the right, with demonstrations outside, with posters, with videos online, being doxed online, for example. And it's also the case that we have to remember that for them, this is one fight. There is not a separation between the anti-abortion fight and the fight over trans rights. For them, they are essential in the vision of gender that for them is motivated and deeply rooted by the Bible. They feel that the United States is a white Christian nation, that it was ordained that way, both by God and by the Constitution, although the founding fathers disagree with them, but, you know, facts don't matter. And what they believe is that women having abortion, people being able to express whom they love through sexual orientation, and the ability to be able to live your true gender identity are all key elements in undermining white Christian America. And so for them, again, this is one fight. And this is not the way that progressives view this. They view trans rights as kind of ancillary, as sort of on the margins, as not being an essential fight, as something that, you know, may be good or may not be good. But for the right, this is an essential fight.
So that's investigative journalist Amara Jones. Amy, as we begin to wrap up, that also leads into the piece you wrote, the op-ed piece you wrote for The New York Times this week, where the pro-choice movement went wrong. Can you talk overall about your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, this is a low moment for the movement for abortion rights, right? We're potentially about to lose the legal right to abortion. And so there are ample factors that have led us to this moment that were well beyond the control of anyone in the abortion rights movement, of course, right? From the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg during the Trump administration to, you know, gerrymandering by Republican lawmakers. But what I wanted to do is understand how the abortion rights movement is reckoning with this moment of loss. So I spoke to more than 50, you know, experts, abortion providers, activists, people involved in this struggle in one way or another. And a really important thread that emerged is that, you know, in the course of basically since Roe v. Wade happened, the white-led groups that have had the bulk of the resources and political capital within the abortion rights movement have often ceded ground and chosen to fight through the courts and fight a more defensive strategy that has really surrendered at many key moments the rights of women of color, Black women in particular, poor people, those whose rights and access were sort of the first to disappear in this incremental battle over abortion rights. And that really starts in 1976 with the passage of the Hyde Amendment. Representative Henry Hyde, who brought it forward, said he wanted to restrict abortion for everyone, but alas, all he had was the Medicaid bill, and so he would have to just restrict it for poor people on Medicaid. And so the Hyde Amendment, which banned federal funding of abortion and eliminated access to abortion for most people who are on Medicaid in most states, was, you know, there were attempts to oppose it at the time, but really what ended up happening is that the Democratic Party and abortion rights groups, a lot of which were white-led at the time, sort of were willing to trade away access for poor people for, you know, other political priorities. And so the Hyde Amendment, the ban on federal funding of abortion, sort of became accepted precedent and accepted and routine part of the budget process for many years. And we're only starting to see that shift now. And I think that's because the reproductive justice framework, the movement led by Black women that has always known that Roe was not enough to protect rights for everyone, that has always known that the courts are not going to save abortion rights because they haven't saved the rights of people of color in the past, quite the contrary. You know, those movements are really sort of moving to the center of the frame and becoming more mainstream. We're seeing for the first time in history that both NARAL and Planned Parenthood are led by women of color. And so I think there is a change coming within the movement because of it reckoning with these past missteps, including, you know, frankly, the failure to adequately protect Black women and to stand up for the safety of the people whose rights were eroded first.
Amy Littlefield, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your articles in The Nation and The New York Times. Amy is a journalist who focuses on reproductive health care and abortion access, correspondent for The Nation. Her new piece for The New York Times is titled Where the Pro-Choice Movement Went Wrong. Amy is a former producer here at Democracy Now! Coming up, What happened to the Haitian asylum seekers in Texas, some of whom were whipped by U.S. Border Patrol agents? Stay with us. Dance of the North by the award-winning Native American musician Joanne Shenandoah. She passed away last week at the age of 64. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at what happened to some of the Haitian asylum seekers we first heard about in September, when the world was shocked by images of U.S. Border Patrol agents on horseback whipping them as they waded across the Rio Grande into Texas. Well, thousands were taking shelter at a makeshift camp underneath a bridge in Del Rio, Texas, after fleeing extreme poverty, political turmoil, violence, and the impacts of the climate catastrophe at home, conditions largely exacerbated by U.S. and foreign intervention in Haiti. Most of the Haitian asylum seekers were mass deported by the Biden administration, but some are still being held in Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE jails. Human rights advocates have raised alarm about dozens now held at the Torrance County Detention Facility in Estancia, New Mexico, about an hour southeast of Albuquerque, where they say asylum seekers are facing abuse and medical neglect. Advocates have also reported asylum seekers have had limited access to legal services and say many of their requests to be released to stay with family members or sponsors while their cases are resolved have been denied. The jails managed by the for-profit private prison corporation CoreCivic. Earlier this year, Torrance actually failed its annual government inspection over severe understaffing, unsanitary, and other unsafe conditions. Torrance also saw a massive COVID outbreak and was sued in May by several asylum seekers after guards pepper sprayed them for launching a peaceful hunger strike last year, protesting inhumane conditions. For more, we're joined in Santa Fe, New Mexico, by immigration attorney Allegra Love of the El Paso Immigration Collaborative. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Allegra. If you can describe who the Haitian asylum seekers are in the Torrance facility, in Estancia, and what's happening to them now.
Good morning. So the people being held at the Torrance facility in Estancia, New Mexico, are, we think, between 60 and 80 of the men who we first saw encamped under the bridge in Del Rio, Texas, for reasons that no one has made clear to me, in spite of the fact that I'm their lawyer, at least 45 of those people's lawyer, we have not been told why they were chosen to be put in this detention center and were spared the expulsion flight that thousands and thousands of their countrymen were subjected to. So they're there, ostensibly seeking asylum, and being held for an administrative hearing for them to be removed to Haiti. Most of my clients were put into the detention facility around September 21st. And so they've been there over 2 months at this point. And we are receiving complaints about food, water, treatment by the staff. And probably scariest to me, we're receiving really, really sincere complaints across the board of medical neglect and people's physical and mental health deteriorating inside of this facility rapidly.
I wanted to read a statement from one of the Haitians you're trying to assist at Torrance. This is from a 25-year-old Haitian man who asked to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation. He wrote, "If I don't have an attorney, I think that they can deport me. I don't know what asylum is. I wasn't allowed to speak. Nobody explained anything, and they just told me I was supposed to have an attorney. I don't want to go back to Haiti. I can't go back. My family member was killed and his house was burned. My mom has just been crying because I cannot go back. If I go back, I can't even leave the airport," he said. Talk more about this situation and what has to be done now, Allegra.
So it's hard. You have to imagine that this is not a detention facility that is next to a big city, next to a place where there's lots of law firms, next to a place where there's a law school who can help all these people. This is in the middle of the barren New Mexico desert. And there are not a lot of lawyers who can help these people with their cases, asylum cases. Are intense, very, very legally complicated, very, very evidence-heavy claims that you need sincere legal assistance to help. We, for a lot of the gentlemen who are detained in that facility, it took us between September 27th was when I first contacted the government, to November 12th to speak with them for the first time in person. So when this person, my client, says, "I don't know what asylum is," he's being sincere. He has not spoken in his own language to someone who is on his side and can help him understand the extremely grave legal process that he's going through. But when he said that, he may have already been through one or two hearings in front of an immigration judge who's actually 300 miles away in El Paso and talks with him over video, and is rapidly trying to remove him from the country and is indifferent to the fact that he has not been able to secure any legal counsel or any even explanation of what asylum is. Detention, I mean, I'm never going to say, there's really no conditions for me that depriving an asylum seeker of their liberty is going to work for me, but it certainly does not work when they cannot get the basic tools and have the basic human contact that they need to save their own lives. And that's what we have in this extremely remote and extremely rural detention center in New Mexico.
Allegra, can you talk about Core Civic, this private for-profit detention prison company that is running this facility that failed an inspection this past year?
Yeah, CoreCivic is one of the biggest private prison corporations in the United States that profits off of ICE keeping immigrant bodies inside of this detention center. Interestingly enough, during the Trump administration, because of the border closures and because of the pandemic, by the end of 2020, right before Trump left office, there was less than a dozen people inside of this detention facility, which meant an enormous loss of profit to a certain extent, to these corporations. Now, we are watching the Biden administration repopulate this rural detention center with immigrants. And it's hard not to conclude that this is to bolster corporate profit. What's really, really alarming about Torrance is it was one of three facilities in the United States that failed their inspections this summer. Failing an inspection is an extremely difficult thing to do. I think your program probably does widespread coverage about how terrible immigration detention is. Yet, most facilities actually pass their inspection, and Torrance fails. Yet, our president and this administration is choosing to repopulate this facility that has not met the standard for caring for human life. They're repopulating it with extremely vulnerable people, extremely vulnerable Haitians. And it's part of a deterrent strategy. It's part of a strategy to make sure that more Haitians don't attempt to come into this country.
Allegra Love, we're going to continue to cover this issue. It is so critical. Immigration attorney with the El Paso Immigration Collaborative speaking to us from Santa Fe, New Mexico today. as we continue on the issue of how the U.S. deals with immigration. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The network of ICE jails across the United States is vast. As we turn from New Mexico to Georgia, where immigrants held at the Irwin County Detention Center were held in solitary confinement after they protested their conditions during the first months of the coronavirus pandemic. Their fight, the focus of a new documentary called The Facility. This is the trailer.
We're asking for these petitioners to be released.
I've already ruled on that, and I haven't heard anything to change my mind.
How's everybody doing? What's happening here?
Somebody here says the pressure for coronavirus.
I'm really scared I'm going to die.
This is what we came up with to try to protect ourselves.
The women, they're going to go on strike.
Detained immigrant women are in utter despair.
We are recording this video in fear.
I have to speak out.
She described the experience here as torture.
They bit me.
They hit me. Can you see?
Can you just keep it running?
People all beating in the hole. Don't put us all in the hole.
Chaos. What have you heard?
They isolated them all.
The facility is going to continue addressing issues as they arise. What that entails, I have no idea.
The Facility is directed by journalist Seth Fried Wessler, who began investigating the story last year. This was 6 months before a whistleblower. A nurse working at the Irwin ICE jail said women held there were being subjected to forced sterilization. At the start of the pandemic, Seth connected with people inside the jail by talking to them through video calls that he recorded. This is a clip.
How's everybody doing? How are you thinking about what's happening out here, this coronavirus thing?
Everybody is here under a lot of stress. We see what's happening outside, how fast it's been moving. Once it gets in here, we all are at risk.
Our safety here is not up to us. It's up to third parties, and these third parties lie to us.
No mienten.
The guards, they only wear their face masks on Monday, and now they don't even have it on at all. As you see, she's going up there checking for everyone.
They are not practicing it, which is the social distance, the 6 feet. With 32 people in here, there's no way we're going to practice that.
I made this myself with a sock to cover my face because I refused to run the risk.
In that clip, you hear Seth Fried Wessler talking to Andrea Manrique and Nilsen Barahona. In a minute, Seth and Nilsen will join us. But first, this is one more clip from the facility where Seth is talking to Nilsen just as a guard comes in and Nilsen confronts him. Listen carefully.
Can you call me after the break?
Can you just keep it running?
There is nobody infected in this facility.
Okay, let me tell you something. My name is Nilsen Barahona. I put a lawsuit, okay, to this facility. Both of the warrants were in a federal court on Thursday, and they declared that they have tested 3 people and 1 came positive.
The people responsible are nowhere to be found. They're all sitting at home somewhere, barking orders, telling people like me what to say to you. It's a f***ed up situation, it really is. The facility is going to continue addressing issues as they arise. What that entails, I have no idea, okay?
Well, for more, we're joined by Nilsen Barahona, one of the 2 people featured in the facility. Originally from Honduras, he has lived in the United States since 1999, since been released from Irwin, helped found the group called Icebreakers. Also with us, Seth Fried Wessler, who was a longtime reporting fellow with Type Investigations when he directed this new documentary produced by Field of Vision, based in part on his reporting for the New York Times Magazine and HuffPost, now a reporter with ProPublica. Seth, this film is about to come out on MSNBC, I believe. Can you talk about how you did these remarkable videos? And then we'll talk with Nilsen about being at the other end.
Yeah, you know, when the pandemic really began to sort of turn the world upside down, I, as a reporter, decided I wanted to try to connect with people inside of the detention centers, the ICE detention centers that I'd already been reporting on. I'd reported on ICE for many years. And so I began to make calls using this pay-per-minute video visitation app that's installed in cell blocks in many detention centers around the country. I knew about the app already because I'd used it to talk to people before the pandemic as I was reporting on ICE. And so I began to make calls to people detained inside of the Irwin County Detention Center to try to figure out what was happening as the pandemic was spreading in this very tightly packed place. And did report a series of stories for the web and for the New York Times Magazine about conditions of confinement, about the failure of ICE and private detention operators to protect people from the spreading virus. But it struck me very early that what I was seeing through these cameras that are attached to tablets inside of the cell blocks, really, I couldn't communicate what I was seeing through print reporting, that this needed to be a story that people could experience visually. And so I embarked on this film project to pull together what ultimately was hundreds of hours of footage that included conversations, interviews with Nilsson and Andrea Manrique and many other people held in Irwin, but also at times just footage of life happening inside. I would sometimes spend many hours a day calling and calling, and then people on the inside, including Nilsson, would pick up my calls. And at times I'd ask, and we just saw a clip of this, if we could just keep the camera running, and I would keep recording the footage. And over time, that practice of just being sort of digitally present made it possible to be present for real things happening inside, events like the one you just saw, and also just sort of to get a sense of the routine daily life inside of this detention center. So the facility, which will come out on MSNBC on Sunday night at 10 p.m., but it's also now available at Field of Vision's website, tells the story of a group of people inside of the Irwin County Detention Center trying to raise their voices to hold the Irwin County Detention Center accountable. But also, I hope, can bring people who see it, in a sense, inside. In a sense, for me, and I think for Nilsson and others I talked to, this camera, not so unlike what we're doing right now, between the detention center, streaming onto my computer screen and then streaming back into these tablets in the inside of the facility, functioned almost like a portal for a moment in and out of a place meant not to be seen in this way.
I mean, it is just an astounding documentary with this firsthand video footage. Even when you're not talking directly to someone, as you point out, you say, leave the camera on, and you hear the guards talking who admit they have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. Nilsson Barahona, you're there at the other end, and we feel you in this documentary, the fear and trying to get an honest answer about if people have COVID at the height of the pandemic and how you can protect yourself. Can you talk about that fear and what they did at Irwin? Now you're out, probably because of, among other things, your resistance and the nurse who came forward and talked about the abominable conditions and the fact that women were being sterilized against their will there.
Yeah, it was definitely a very frightening time, you know. It was in order for me to fight this fight, and I have said this many times, I had to block my emotions because what we was living at that time, it was overwhelming, you know, and it was easy to freeze and not to do anything. But I'm a man of faith, and I give thanks to God that I was able to connect with Steph and Diego Sanchez and Laura Lay, you know, my lawyers at that time. They were great help. They were shining the light every step I take, you know. And I'm grateful that this documentary came out, because there is no words that can explain what we went through at that time.
And talk about what it meant to demand answers about how you could be protected during COVID. I mean, you see Andrea, the other woman in detention who gets punished for resisting and going on hunger strike and the agony she goes through in this facility for almost 2 years. You were on hunger strike as well, Nelson.
Yeah, it was a decision that it wasn't really easy to make, you know, also the fact that we were all able to do this together as a family. I would say there is no other way to say it, because we knew that all we had, it was next to us, you know, everything that we have that we can use to fight, it was next to us, and it was each other. That was basically it. So we got to come together and we got to raise our voice in order to get the attention that we needed to get to solve that problem.
I mean, when you describe, as you're talking to Seth on this video call, about your son and what he said to you as you spoke to him in Spanish, you're inside, he's out, you're married, he's an American citizen, he's a tiny boy. But the little bond that you had and what you felt was being disrupted.
It's still hard to this point to think about it. Thanks God, I'm able to say right now that bond is stronger than ever. My boy, he's 7 years old at this time, but his courage and his character is so strong, and I'm proud of him, you know. But the truth is that it should have never happened, you know. I should have never been taken away from him. He was 5 years old at the time when I got detained. And you know, during the months went by, and I tried to keep that relationship, you know, going, but we were limited, you know, in the kind of communication that we could have. And since he was born, I only speak Spanish to him. So this is me. This is our thing, you know. My wife is a United States citizen. She's from Connecticut, and so. She speaks a little Spanish, but not much. So I try to make sure that he knows his background, you know, where he's coming from, and all our culture and all that. And I felt like I was losing that, you know, with him. And I felt so impotent, you know. There was nothing I could do at that time. But what hurt me is the fact that how come your own government can be doing this to you, you know? Like my wife went through so much. Like she was, when I came out, she was financially, emotionally, physically drained, because all the things that we were supposed to do and take care as a couple, she would have to do it on her own. And not only that, but now she had an extra care of having her husband in detention.
And as you ask, and as Andrea asked, when you're just released, after how long were you in Irwin?
13 months.
13 months. And oh, she, Irwin, 2 years.
And I was in Irwin for like 7 months. And then after the hunger strike, I was moved to a Stewart detention center.
You were moved to Stewart.
Which is not better at all.
And saying, why couldn't you be at home as you went through the process? Andrea, they're breaking her. And in these last few seconds, Seth, the agony we watch Andrea, who had been put in the hole, who had gone on hunger strike, saying, after they released her, why couldn't she have been waiting for her court date all this time from home?
You know, ICE detention is in many ways unique in the complex of ways that we lock people up in the United States, in that it is routinely the case that people don't know how long they will be held. They don't know when they will be released. People can be held for many months and sometimes multiple years. And this is a detention system that is at the discretion of ICE. ICE can decide to hold people or not. everybody who's in ICE detention could be released and allowed to be home with their families. And that's a decision that the government makes
every
day.
We have to leave it there, but you can see the documentary, The Facility, at MSNBC and Field of Vision. Seth Fried Wessler and Nielsen Barona, thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
When it comes to vaping, the truth can get clouded. So let's make it clear. Vaping is not safe for kids, teens, or young adults. It's just not.
Because vaping can put microscopic particles into your lungs.
And dangerous things like metals and volatile organic compounds into your body.
And nicotine, the same highly addictive substance found in regular cigarettes.
Nicotine can harm a person's brain development through their mid-20s.
Affecting learning, memory, attention, and impulse control. And priming the brain for other addictions.
Vaping products also come in kid-friendly flavors that can make them appealing to youth.
And many kids also use other drugs, like marijuana, in vaping devices.
With appealing flavors, high nicotine levels, and lots of promotion on social media,
many kids think vaping is harmless, but it's not.
So talk to your kids about the risks of vaping, because when you talk, they hear you.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh. Guess what? My name is Paul. This is a show called the Viva Lamach radio program. And it's at that time of the show. We're midway through this program. We do a WRCT radio and a WRCT music calendar. Before I get to either of those, I want to remind you that Row House Cinema joins you in supporting WRCT. Now, Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater located in the historic Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh. And each week, they choose a new movie theme. And they show classic, cult, foreign, animated, fun, and fascinating films in a magical setting. Their concession stand features natural popcorn with real butter, craft beer, and vegan options. Yeah, so that is Row House Cinema. They're located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, rowhousecinema.com or call them up at 412-904-3225. And don't forget, if you are actually interested in underwriting WRCT, maybe you're interested in underwriting the Viva Lamach radio program. Huh? Think about that. Send an email to pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. Speaking of partnership opportunities, it is time now for me to do the WRCT radio calendar. Let you know some events going on around town, some things that maybe you're like, I got nothing to do this weekend. Mockster, what should I do? Well, you know what? We are in the month of August, which means we are running low on times that you can catch the cinema in the park. Or not the, no, I'm talking about the Cary Carpool Cinema. That's what I was talking about, because that, I think, ends in August. And what is that? It's where the Cary Blast Furnace out in Rankin is your backstop for movies. Yeah, it's a drive-in like no other. Rivers of Steel invites you to experience this drive-in. Find out more at riversofsteel.com/experiences for the schedule and exact dates that they're doing it. Now, that Cinema in the Park I mentioned, that's going on through August as well. And what is that? Well, it kind of tells you what it is. It's the Dollar Bank Cinema in the Park. It's at Schenley Park, right there on Flagstaff Hill, which is so right behind Carnegie Mellon University there. And it has returned. You bring along a blanket or a lawn chair, and you head out for an unforgettable evening of free cinema under the stars. Cinema in the Park is showing movies at 9 other spaces as well, 7 days a week. To find out more information, go to pittsburghpa.gov/cinema. The Flagstaff Hill one is happening on Wednesdays, so just keep that in mind. Don't forget, On Tuesdays, it's the Lawrenceville Farmers Market. It happens from 3 to 7 at Arsenal Park in Lawrenceville. Over 30 vendors each and every Tuesday.